Session number 9861, Reel 1.
Well, if I can preface that by going back to my boyhood, when I was at school, I could not understand why nations had to go to war. The memories of World War I, or what I was brought up against that background, and I couldn't understand how men could go through what they went through in the front line and still keep going. And I thought, that isn't for me. And I had a sort of revulsion against war when I was at Stowe, 15, 16 years old. When I got to Oxford in 1936, Hitler was rising. And somehow everything changed. And without understanding it, you felt that there was a threat to peace. Until he was stopped, there could be no peace. Come 1938, Munich, again without understanding, because we didn't understand the truth about it, I felt that something wrong had been done. I felt that we'd let the side down. And I felt convinced that war was going to come. So I asked my father if I could be released from Oxford to join the Air Force. I was then a member of the Air Squadron, Oxford University Air Squadron. Well, obviously he said no, and obviously in those days you obeyed him. But you were then able to apply for a direct entry, for permanent commission direct entry from Oxford. If you were accepted, it took effect when and if you passed your finals. So I applied for a direct entry permanent commission in, I suppose it was September 38. And I was given it. It wasn't very difficult. You had a very simple medical. You asked if you could read the exit sign over the board, over the door. He did two or three knees up, and he looked at you to see if you were totally out of breath. And he asked you what games you played, and that was about it, as far as I can remember. So I was in. But that didn't take effect till 39. Of course, war had broken out on September the 3rd. I was called up sometime end of September.
How had you reacted when war was declared? Was it with horror or resignation or what?
My first thought was, because bombing, everybody had a sort of a mania about bombing. We were convinced we were going to be bombed from every side. So the moment I heard an aeroplane in the sky, I immediately looked up, convinced it would be a German. I did stupid things, like going off and buying rabbit snares, because I thought, well, we're going to have to batten down the hatches and we'll be short of food. But then, as I hadn't been called up, I went to the recruiting centre and I offered my services, and I found myself doing something which I eventually refused to do, and that was, I was receiving people behind a desk and taking their details and then allocating them to where they were to go to. I thought I didn't want that responsibility of allocating one man to one operation and so on. So I asked to be given a different job. Well, I think I just took war as a matter of course. You felt it was coming. It had come. We couldn't picture what it was going to be like. I remember very vividly asking myself the question, what will happen when I'm under gunfire? And I couldn't picture myself coping under gunfire. I can picture that little scene very vividly, with a postman arriving with the letters and looking at me and saying, "You're looking a bit solemn, Gov," as he used to call you then.
Can you tell me about your pilot's training, how you found that?
Yeah. Well, I joined the Air Squadron, not so much by choice. I chose the cavalry first. Oh, I'd like something a bit different from infantry. So I opted for cavalry, but it was very unpleasant. You turned up at 7 in the morning, in a drill hall. You were shouted at by a sergeant major. You ran at a horse and leapt on it. And you had to get off the horse by somersaulting backwards off it. And I thought, well, again, this isn't for me. And what's the most sedentary I can think of? And the most sedentary seemed to be the Air Force. So I went to the Air Squadron. And I just took to it. I mean, I didn't take to infantry work. I didn't take to rifle shooting. But the moment I was in an aeroplane, I just felt at home. So I was lucky. I wasn't a specially good pilot, but I just liked it.
Did you find anything about flying that you especially liked, that you could single out?
Low flying I liked. Didn't like aerobatics. Slightly nervous of aerobatics.
What was it about low flying that was attractive?
No, I can't tell you. I'd liked fast cars. I'd had an Alfa Romeo. I liked speed, and it was only low down got the sensation of speed. I liked flying under high tension cables and so on. I mean, it wasn't irrational. I just liked it. I used to do it whenever I thought I'd get away with it. In fact, it stood me in good stead later.
Now, when you entered the RAF, were you allocated to bomber command at an early stage?
No, well, I was sent to EFTS, Hull Abington, Elementary Flying Training School. And towards the end of that, you were given three choices of your operational command. And I had it firmly fixed in my mind I did not want bomber command, because they were doing these daylight Blenheim and battle sorties, and they obviously were highly dangerous. So I thought I'd get out of that. So I put light bombers first. I didn't think I liked fighter command because of aerobatics. I put light bombers first, Army Co-op second, and Fighter Command third. Of course, they posted me to heavy bombers. You know, so we thought to ourselves, what was the idea of asking us to put our choice down?
Which squadron were you posted to, first of all?
Well, I first went to conversion unit at Abingdon, which is where I'd learned to fly. That's where, next to Oxford. That's right next, very next to our own house. So I converted on to Whitley's. Then I was posted to 102 Squadron, Driffield, flying Whitley's, on approximately June the 7th, 1940.
How did you find the Whitley to fly?
I liked the Whitley. She was safe. She would take a lot of punishment. She was easy to fly. But I was very fortunate when I turned up at my squadron, because I was given a very good captain. Flight Lieutenant Long, New Zealander. He'd already got a DFC. He was a pre-war pilot. He knew what he was doing. He put me through my paces. He was very severe in a disciplinary sense. I mean, as regards knowing the aeroplane and knowing my flight route rules and so on. But yet very human. And he used to let me in the flying seat quite early on over Germany. And captains never do that with their second pilots. That meant that I'd had experience of flying over enemy territory with him beside me before I'd take on my own. Usually a captain would only let you in the seat after you'd crossed the enemy coast. So I owe Lofty a lot.
Can you remember what your first mission over German-held territory was?
Yes, it was Abbeville, the bridge at Abbeville. Because this was Dunkirk time.
Does that mission particularly stand out in your memory in any way?
No. I mean, I wrote a book in 1941, a racy sort of book, and it's all that is described there. No, none of those raids stand out in my mind.
Because in that battle for France, the British Army were forever saying, "Where's the RAF?"
Yeah, well, I don't blame them. But we didn't. The fighter command didn't have the range to get there. And what could? I mean, night heavy bombers. We had no accurate navigation. We had no night bomb sites. It made me think from an early time that we should be bombing low level, or anyway, marking low level, and bombing an accurate marker. I started putting papers up to that effect when I was still in 102.
How were they received?
Oh, quite well by the CO, but they didn't get any further than that, to my knowledge. Because we were bombed out from Driffield, and so lunchtime, they completely razed the station. So we were moved away from Driffield and taken off onto Atlantic anti-sub work.
Were you there at Driffield when it was bombed?
Yes.
What date was that approximately?
I would think sometime in August. I could soon confirm it.
During the Battle of Britain?
Yeah, you see, we were right on the coast. They came in the quarters at lunchtime. Fighter command said they shot them all down, leaving the target. And we said, why didn't you do it a bit earlier? Might as well have shot them down before they got to us.
Can you describe what the raid was like, from your personal observation?
The sirens went just the end of lunch. I remember the station commander diving under the messroom table. I decided to go for the shelter at the end of the mess. And we were being bombed quite heavily by dive bomb by Stukas, I think they were. Well, I don't know what they were. When I got to the end of the door at the end of the mess, there was one of the pilots was standing there transfixed, looking upwards. And I looked upwards, and there was a Stuka coming down, and the bombs had left him. You could actually see the bombs coming down. And I remember putting my foot in the small of this fellow's back and saying, move or run or something, and pushing him as hard as I could. And I've never covered, there's about 15 yards between there and those steps. I never covered 15 yards as quickly as I did then. I dived down the steps, head first. But he never moved. It landed right on top of him. First time I realized that people can get transfixed by a threat. He just couldn't move. I remember the padre being very... He was walking around out in the open in the bombs, sort of encouraging people.
Were there many casualties on that raid?
Yeah, a lot of our aircraft went. Hangars were hit. Yes, there must have been quite a lot of casualties.
You said then you went on to anti-submarine work.
Yes. And then... what happened? Oh, then I was posted to the 1st Halifax Squadron. Then we came back and did more. Yes, then we came back and did more bombing raids in Whitley. And then I got badly shot up over Cologne. We had a direct hit. You won't want all that story, but I had a direct hit which blew a 10-foot hole out of the fuselage and set fire to the aircraft. And very badly wounded the wireless op. But we managed to get her back. I was given a field DSO for that and taken off for 10 days for a Lorenz course. And then completed more trips in 102. But then I was posted to the 1st Halifax Squadron, 35 Squadron.
How did you find the Halifax in comparison with what you've been flying so far?
Well, she carried a heavier bomb load. She didn't have the same safety margin. You had no duel in those days. You just did one trip standing behind the CO. And he got out and said, over to you, and you got in, and that was it. So in a sense, you didn't quite get to learn the aircraft as well as you did doing a conversion course on a Whitley, because it changed later, but there wasn't as yet a conversion course onto Halifaxes. Yes, they went higher, they carried more. Obviously, they'd moved into a new level of bombing.
Could you say at this point what your opinion of the Luftwaffe was as a fighting force? Speaking generally over the whole war?
Well, I never really had much to do with them, because I was seldom attacked by a fighter. Yes, they did that bombing raid on Driffield, but I mean, that was just, we were just over the coast. I know from what other people told me what they'd experienced in France, because that was a completely different Luftwaffe from what we knew. Because we were bombing at night, so in a way we had the advantage. But the battles and the Blenheims, they had no hope in the Battle of France. So had you been in the Air Force a year earlier, your chances of survival were dramatically reduced. We had a respect for them, but we felt we had the edge on them in bomber command due to the fact we were operating at night.
Are there any raids over Germany that stick out in your mind as special, that you can recollect in detail?
There was a 1,000 bomber raid. But I was off the squadron, then I was on doing my first between tour instruction work at Marston Moor. Yeah, I remember that vividly because that had all sorts of sides to it. But, I mean, I don't know to what extent you're interested in just the personal side of it.
Yes.
But before I come to that, the thing that sticks out in my mind was the need to be totally professional. The odds were of surviving a tour were against you. So if you wanted to survive, you had at least to cut down the possibility of not getting through because of a mistake on your side. The rest you could only leave to Providence. You felt this was a war you had to win. So every mission that we did was an important mission. And I obviously people varied, but the people I knew felt that at all costs we had to hit the target. And the equipment and the weather and the whole technique was against you, finding a target at night. So it needed a total commitment of mind and of heart to mastering your aircraft and your bombing technique, and also to establishing the best possible relationship with your air crew and your ground crew. And I think particularly the ground crew, because you depended on your ground crew. When you were flying, they were out at this coal dispersal point. And there they were waiting for you when you came back. And if all you did was say, thanks very much, and jumped into your lorry and went off your eggs and bacon, you weren't going to have much of a relationship with them. I found it very important to build up a good friendship with them, to let them know that you cared about them, that you appreciated what they did, and let them know that if they were in trouble, you were going to see them through.
Can you give some specific instances of how you went about that?
Well, I'd always go out and visit them and have a chat with them. When I say always, when I got the chance during the day. And then I'd talk about the aircraft and what they'd found and so on. And then that would lead you on to other things about them. I'd try to find out something about themselves so that you knew them as a person. Now, in my case, I only once had an engine failure in 4 years of bombing, and that was on an air test, so it didn't matter. I never had engine or airframe failure that affected a flight, except that air test. So that speaks for the quality of the, well, A, the manufacturer, but two, of their servicing. And I think that getting to know them must have had some effect on that. You can't quantify. But curiously, in the last year, I've met about five of my aircrew, my ground crew, who remember that one of them, a fortnight ago, remembers specifically that time we were hit in the Whitley over Cologne, described the landing vividly. He said, you came back an hour late, which is true, with the side flapping. He said, you did a circuit of the aircraft, the aerodrome, to let us know what the problem was. You had no WT. He said, we were taking bets as to whether when you landed, the aircraft, the back of the aircraft would break. I said, it didn't, did it? He said, no, it didn't, work fine. And then in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, I met my personal fitter from 617, looked after my Mustang. It's quite meaningful, really, to meet them again and be able to relive your relationship. Because I think the attention of the world is focused on the people who dropped the bombs and stormed the beaches. But in fact, that wasn't quite the way it worked. The whole country was one unit. It was one team. And you felt that you were part of a, I don't know what the word is, but you felt that you were all together. The people on the street, if they saw that your air crew, would sort of give you a nod or a word of encouragement. You knew that the women working in the factories were doing their best to give you good equipment. And all that played, in my mind, a crucial part in giving you the incentive to get on with it and do your job.
Do you think there was more of a team spirit amongst the British population generally in the war than after the war?
Well, I wouldn't think you could compare it. I mean, once the war's gone, we got no national objective. That's the thing that struck me so forcibly at the end of the war. I'd gone straight from the university to the war. I'd known nothing but a united country. We were up against a threat which we knew would sink us if we didn't deal with it. You had a sense of urgency. And as I remember one of the Norwegians saying, you had a kind of cold inner anger. Because although you didn't know exactly what Hitler was doing, you had a pretty good idea. And it gave, because the Norwegians, they knew they'd escaped from an occupied country. But I don't believe that any time in my life I've lived at such intensity as I did during the war. I mean, people say to me, your work since the war amongst disabled people is, you know, a bigger thing than fighting the war. And, well, I don't know how you compare, but in terms of inner commitment, I don't believe my commitment now is what it was in the war. Because I don't think that anybody can be as committed as you are when you know it's sink or swim.
Coming back to what you were saying earlier about the equipment, can you recollect from your own personal point of view any changes in equipment that occurred which seemed to make a big difference from your personal memory?
Yeah, well, if you take the Halifax, we woke up to the fact one day that no Halifax ever came back on three engines. Now, that made you sit up and ask why. Other aircraft were coming back with three engines. And as we weren't quite certain, I took my Halifax up and I cut one engine and I let her stall. And the moment that happened, I got into a stall from which I couldn't recover. And the only way that I could recover was by cutting the two outboard motors on the outside of the spiral, opening up the two inboard engines, full throttle to counter the spin, and put both my feet on the rudder, again to counter the spin. The standard technique of pushing the stick forward made no effect at all. So I knew immediately that anybody who got into a spin over Germany was sunk. He had no hope of getting back. And the margin of error, the safety margin between the speed at which you could fly with three engines at height and stall was only about 15 to 20 miles an hour. So it was self-evident that there was something wrong with the design. So we did two things. I took the underneath turret off, which is a lookout turret for a gunner, in order to gain more speed. Thought that was more important than a lookout. And I reported it to Halifax. So that's to Handley Page. Well, Handley Page refused to do anything about it because he had made a promise to Churchill that he'd produce so many aircraft and he was not going to hold up production. It was then referred to whatever the research station was in Salisbury Plain. Doesn't matter. And they undertook tests, same as I was doing, and a Polish test pilot was killed trying to get out of the spin that I had difficulty getting out of. And I remember that Handley Pages would not even send flowers to his funeral because they didn't want to be associated. And that caused great bitterness amongst the squadrons. But in the end, they redesigned the tailplane. So the Mark II Halifax had a rounded tailplane instead of a square one. See, the problem about heavy bombing, there were two fundamental problems, both of which bear on the bomber offensive. The first is that the concept of a heavy bomber was that you put armour plating and defensive guns to counter the threat of flak and fighters. The more you put on, the slower you get, or alternatively, the lower your bomb load. So you're caught in a... In order to achieve the objective of the offensive, you've got to deliver so many bombs accurately on their targets without worrying about what number is. The weakness of the heavy bomber was firstly that it had to be heavily defended, and that was reducing the bomb load. The second fundamental problem was that in order to bomb a target accurately, you had to see your aiming point well in advance, ideally 40 miles in advance, so you could do a long straight bombing run. But self-evidently, you can't identify a target till you're over the top. Now, the burden of my case, which I've been putting up since the end of beginning of 1941, was that the target should be marked, but it should be marked by an aircraft that didn't suffer from the disadvantage of a high-flying heavy bomber. It should be marked by a manoeuvrable low-flying aircraft, which having got over the target and identified, it could then dive straight onto it. Well, that was... I don't know how far that proposal ever got, but it didn't get very far. When Pathfinders were formed, I mean, they'd realised by this time the the weakness of Bomber Command, delivering so few targets to the aiming point.
So few bombs. So few bombs to the aiming point.
Yes, such a small percentage of its bombs are falling within 5 miles of the aiming point. Well, the solution proposed by Bennett was give me better crews and better equipment. Well, there was sense in that. But in my humble view, it wasn't attacking the root of the problem, because you were still employing an aircraft that was fundamentally not suited to bombing accurately an aiming point that it could only see when it was too close to drop a bomb. Well, my view would have remained a personal view had it not come to 617.